Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 309, titled The Ties That Bind. This is being recorded on July 1st of the year 2001. It's a 2 half-hour segment program. We're going to begin with a topic that occupied much of the discussion in For the Record program number 306 and 307 in particular. In that broadcast, we looked at the re-election of Propaganda Due member, former Propaganda Due member Silvio Berlusconi. He had been Prime Minister of Italy in 1994, and in particular we noted that part of his coalition, both in 1994 and in 2001, consisted of the heirs to Mussolini, specifically the Alleanza Nazionale, the direct successor to Mussolini's Fascisti, and the MSI organization, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, that succeeded it, and elements that are even more ripe, so to speak, than the Alleanza Nazionale. And we're going to begin this examination of not only fascism around the world, but some of the institutions that are significant in terms of the development of fascism with discussion of one of the key aspects of Silvio Berlusconi's prime ministership and also of his election campaign, namely the absolutely paramount role that Silvio Berlusconi plays in the world of Italian media, and that would literally be impossible to exaggerate. I can imagine that there are X number of listeners who wonder why I've been spending the amount of time I've been spending over the past several years on German corporate control of the American media, or even more significantly, perhaps, Bormann corporate control over the American media, that reference being to the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, about which I've spoken so often, and that we will be discussing again later on in this broadcast. And I can appreciate that the amount of time that I've spent discussing that will appear to be perhaps inordinate or unwarranted to some members of the listening audience. I can also appreciate that not only the Bormann organization, but in particular the Nazi track Serpent's Walk, might appear to be obscure and perhaps unimportant to some listeners. But in addition to the significance of the Bormann organization and the significance that I attribute to the book Serpent's Walk, one should note that control of the media is absolutely essential for any form of totalitarian government. If you control the media and the educational system, you pretty much control things. An article that discussed one of many stories that discussed the absolutely enormous, the pivotal role that Silvio Berlusconi plays in the Italian media was discussed. One of the many articles that discussed that was in the Financial Times of Wednesday, June 27th of the year 2001. This is an article by James Blitz in Rome. It's headlined, Berlusconi Sets Out Stall on Public and Private Roles, and it reads in part as follows. Silvio Berlusconi, Italy's new prime minister, has begun spelling out how he plans to resolve the conflict of interest between his public and private roles. But his approach is already under attack from Italy's center-left opposition and leading figures in the country's academic establishment. Mr. Berlusconi, who was elected prime minister on May 13th, fully owns Fininvest, an unlisted holding company based in Milan. By the way, that's spelled F-I-N-I-N-V-E-S-T, one word. Continuing. Fininvest has a controlling stake in Mediaset, which runs Italy's three main private television channels. Fininvest also controls Mondadori, the country's biggest publishing house, and a series of leading Italian companies in the financial services and advertising sectors. And again, I would think that that would speak for itself in terms of an individual who is not only prime minister, but who is part of a coalition involving the fascisti that are the heirs to Mussolini's fascisti. The significance of Berlusconi's media role, and by the way, as we looked at in Miscellaneous Archive Show M61 and also in For the Record Program 229 and in For the Record Program number 307, Berlusconi himself was a former member of the P2 Lodge of Italian fascist Licio Gelli. In fact, this past week someone informed me that Licio Gelli actually has a homepage on the web, and one of the things that is listed on the Licio Gelli homepage is the nomenclature of the membership of the P2 as of 1981 when it was busted, and right there is Silvio Berlusconi. Commentary on Berlusconi's media role was contained in an article that was carried in the Wall Street Journal of Wednesday, May 9th of the year 2001. This is an article by Yaroslav Trofimov. It's Dateline Rome, headlined, Berlusconi Steams Ahead Toward Italy's Vote on Sunday. Obviously, this was written before Silvio Berlusconi was elected. The significance of Berlusconi's media role was characterized as follows. Skipping down in the story, Umberto Eco, one of Italy's most respected writers, this week published an appeal to vote against Mr. Berlusconi, saying the tycoon, who will control three state TV networks as prime minister, in addition to the other three he owns personally, will turn Italy into a, quote, de facto dictatorship, unquote. Well, control of the media, period, turns a country into a de facto dictatorship. In theory, at least, the Fourth Estate, the media, the press, is supposed to keep the political establishment to a certain extent in line. That's a role that our media establishment fills imperfectly, in my assessment. But the significance of Berlusconi's media empire to his political success, and in turn the implications of that media empire for his stewardship as prime minister and the forces that he represents, could not be exaggerated. Turning once again to the makeup of Silvio Berlusconi's fascist coalition, and by that I mean that his coalition formally embraces many of Italy's fascist parties, we're going to turn once again to an article that we looked at in For the Record program number 307. This is an article from the Financial Times of Monday, June 11th of the year 2001. This also is by James Blitz in Rome, and it's headlined, Italy's new prime minister appoints right-wingers to coalition government. And in a discussion of some of the appointments that he has made, there's an interesting corporate affiliation, and we're going to use this as sort of a jumping-off point to examine some of the history of fascism and some of the connections that fascism maintains and has maintained since over the decades since Mussolini first acceded to power in Italy. Skipping down in this story, among the most prominent names was Antonio Martino of Forza Italia, who becomes defense minister, Letizia Moratti, former executive in Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, is to be Minister for Education. So one can assume that perhaps Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation's affiliates in Italy will be relatively pro-Berlusconi. Yet another interesting connection here. Lucio Stanca, S-T-A-N-C-A, a former IBM executive, becomes Minister for Innovation and Technology. I'm not implying that the fact that this gentleman was a former IBM executive is necessarily in and of itself significant, but we should note that IBM is one of many major world corporations that was enthusiastically pro-Axis in the Second World War. Of course, they also helped the Allied side. What should be noted here is that Mussolini's corporate state, and that's what Mussolini called his fascist system, that's the focal point of a miscellaneous archive show, M42, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State. We discussed Mussolini's corporate state and the enthusiastic and pivotal support it received from the United States. Mussolini called his system, his fascist system, the corporate state, and I actually excerpted some passages from Mussolini's a collection of Mussolini's speeches published under the title The Corporate State, did that in the aforementioned M42 and also in For the Record program number 268. In For the Record program number 279, among other broadcasts, we took a look at a recent book called IBM and the Holocaust by Edwin Black that discusses not only IBM's pivotal assistance to the Axis forces in World War II, the Third Reich in particular, but it also discussed the pro-fascist and pro-Axis affiliations and affinities of Thomas Watson, the head of IBM. We're going to read now of Thomas Watson's affection for and political respect for Mussolini, the founder of the corporate state. This is, once again, from IBM and the Holocaust, published in hardcover by Crown Publishers, copyright 2001. The ISBN number is 0-609-60799-5. And of IBM head Thomas Watson's affiliations with or an affinity for Benito Mussolini, we read, fascism, the dictatorial, state-controlled political system, was invented by Italian dictator Benito Mussolini. The term symbolically derived from the Roman fasces, that is, the bundle of rods surrounding a ceremonial axe used during Roman times. Indeed, Nazi symbols and ritual were in large part adopted from Mussolini, including the palm-lifting Roman salute. Ironically, Italian fascism was non-racial and not anti-Semitic. National Socialism added those defining elements. Mussolini fascinated Watson. Once at a 1937 sales convention, Watson spoke out in Il Duce's defense. Quote, "I want to pay tribute to the great leader Benito Mussolini," declared Watson. "I have followed the details of his work very carefully since he assumed leadership in 1922. Evidence of his leadership can be seen on all sides. Mussolini is a pioneer. Italy is going to benefit greatly." Watson explained his personal attraction to the dictator's style and even observed similarities with his own corporate capitalistic model. "One thing which has greatly impressed me in connection with his leadership," conceded Watson, "is the loyalty displayed by the people. To have the loyalty and cooperation of everyone means progress and ultimate success for a nation or an individual business. We should pay tribute to Mussolini for establishing this spirit of loyal support and cooperation," unquote. For years, an autographed picture of Mussolini graced the grand piano in Watson's living room. In defense of fascism, Watson made clear, quote, "Different countries require different forms of government, and we should be careful not to let people in other countries feel that we are trying to standardize principles of government throughout the world." Perhaps that's the reason why an autographed picture of Mussolini graced the grand piano in Watson's living room. As we looked at in For the Record program number 279, and as is documented at considerable length in the book IBM and the Holocaust, IBM's operations were absolutely essential to those of the Third Reich, not just for the identification of Jews and other ethnic minorities who were targeted for discrimination and or extermination, but also because the mechanized and centralized German industrial infrastructure was greatly enhanced by the IBM machines that were put at the disposal of the Third Reich. One of the central people involved in coordinating Third Reich activities with IBM, and also one of the central people involved with coordinating Third Reich activities with other major corporations, American corporations in particular, and an individual who also wore the hat of German State Department or Foreign Ministry operative, an individual whose career touches on many elements that we've examined over the years in our discussions of international fascism. This is a fellow named Edmund Weissenmayer, Weissenmayer. And Weissenmayer's career with the Third Reich, his role as a coordinator between Nazi Germany and key corporations around the world, and some of his many activities involving the identification and liquidation of Jews in occupied countries, and also his activities coordinating with pro-Axis elements in the Middle East, and also the brutal Ustashi, the predecessors of the, quote, independent, unquote, Croatian nationalists in the newly formed state of Croatia, independent Croatia. We've discussed the fascist heritage of the current Croatian state in numerous broadcasts available from Spitfire. Time permitting, I will give you the address for Spitfire and their website later on in the broadcast. Weissenmayer, in addition to coordinating the Third Reich's activities with IBM and other corporations, as I said, his activities could be seen as something of a microcosm for many of the elements that I've discussed over the years, and I'm going to read a couple of pages from IBM and the Holocaust about Edmund Weissenmayer, one of the main corporate liaison individuals for Nazi Germany, and an individual who has wielded a significant, although largely unrecognized, role in contemporary history. Edwin Black writes as follows in IBM and the Holocaust. Even though Edmund Weissenmayer lived at Auguststrasse 12 in Lichterfelde, just around the corner from Dehomag's Berlin headquarters, Dehomag is the German IBM subsidiary, he had declined to make his presence known to Chauncey until the first days of December 1940. Weissenmayer was one of Berlin's quiet but powerful Nazis, often feared, who helped to directly implement the most dramatic phases of Hitler's plans for Europe and the Jews. He was just a step or two removed from Der Führer, and was, from time to time, summoned for consultations by Hitler personally, a claim few would dare make, but a claim that was nonetheless quite correct. Although Weissenmayer proudly wore the full uniform and regalia of his SS rank, he avoided noisy street riots and ghetto roundups in favor of boardrooms and embassies. Always lurking in the shadows as Eastern Europe's most heinous actions erupted, Weissenmeyer was Hitler's most trenchant facilitator. Born Catholic in 1904 in the town of Bad Kissingen, amid the pastoral rolling hills and lush forests of Bavaria, Weissenmeyer quickly took to political economics. He became a professor of economics and business administration at the Technical College in Munich. Weissenmeyer joined the NSDAP early in 1932 when he was only 28 years old. When National Socialism came to power in 1933, he became the personal secretary and economic advisor to Wilhelm Kepler, Hitler's personal economic advisor. As such, Kepler functioned as Weissenmeyer's direct connection to the Führer and the most powerful officials in Germany. Kepler was not only Hitler's personal economic advisor, he was also Germany's main nexus to American business. Dubbed a Kodak man by U.S. military intelligence reports for his links to the Eastman Kodak Film Company, Kepler owed much to the Kodak Company. Before the rise of Hitler, Kepler enjoyed managerial positions with several firms that produced photographic gelatins, including one that exported heavily to Eastman Kodak in America and Kodak Limited in England. Kodak financed 50% of Kepler's Odin Company, which specialized in photogels. Once Hitler came to power, Kepler advised a number of American companies on terminating their Jewish employees. He maintained good relations with executives connected to such companies as International Telephone and Telegraph and National Cash Register, and was Hitler's intermediary to such commercial giants as General Motors. Largely through his Kepler connections, Weissenmeyer eventually joined the board of directors of the German subsidiaries of International Telephone and Telegraph and Standard Oil, by the way, in Uncle Sam and the Swastika and numerous other programs, including For the Record Program 216. We took a look at the profound connections between Standard Oil and the Third Reich. In number 278, we reviewed the connections between Standard Oil and the Bormann Organization. Continuing. Weissenmeyer traveled in executive circles and spoke the language of big business. But Weissenmeyer was more than just a corporate liaison. He was arguably considered Reich Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop's most important personal troubleshooter and advance man. A technical expert on the eradication of Jewish communities, Weissenmeyer was invaluable as a behind-the-scenes organizer in Hitler's war against the Jews. As such, he had a keen appreciation for statistics and Hollerith capabilities. U.S. military intelligence described his meteoric ascent within the Reich's anti-Jewish destruction machine as, quote, an amazing career which took him on missions to southeastern Europe, always, it would seem, at a moment of trouble, unquote. In the months leading up to the March 1938 Anschluss with Austria, Weissenmeyer functioned as the Foreign Office's principal economic expert in Vienna. The day before Austria was taken over on March 12th, Weissenmeyer shuttled Himmler, that's Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS, from a Vienna airfield to the German embassy to help form a new Austrian Nazi regime. The next day, however, before the puppet Austrian government could be installed, Hitler annexed the country altogether. A year later, in early March of 1939, Weissenmeyer traveled to Bratislava to help engineer the destruction of Czechoslovakia and the declaration of a puppet state in Slovakia. On about March 11th, he drove two hand-picked Slovak leaders to Vienna, where they met Kepler, and then flew on to Berlin for a meeting with Hitler. On that same day, Weissenmeyer wired the Foreign Office, Alle Juden in der Hand, that is, all Jews in hand, unquote. He remained in Bratislava on March 15th while Czechoslovakia was dismantled. Jews were quickly identified in the days to come. Weissenmeyer was a frequent liaison to foreign militant movements. In early 1940, he was assigned to coordinate with two members of the Irish Republican Army visiting Berlin. Later in Rome, he met with the virulent anti-Semites Amin Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and Rashid Ali Gailani, former Iraqi premier. He escorted both men to Berlin for meetings with Hitler. Haji Amin al-Husseini, the former Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, is an individual we've discussed in numerous broadcasts, including RFA number 22, and numerous broadcasts in conjunction with the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, most recently For the Record program number 293. He was, among other things, the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement and a major in the SS. We've also spoken about Ali Rashid, who led a pro-Axis anti-British uprising in Iraq. One of his political supporters was a fellow named Karula al-Tufah, who is the political mentor and uncle of Saddam Hussein. Continuing, speaking of Weissenmeyer's liaisons with Haj Amin al-Husseini and Rashid Ali, he escorted both men to Berlin for meetings with Hitler. It was also Weissenmeyer who, in April of 1941, brokered a written political agreement between Yugoslavian fascists and a murderous Croatian militia known as the Ustashi, helping the Croats remain in power as Nazi surrogates with the support of the German Foreign Office. This, by the way, is the pro-Axis Croatian government that I alluded to earlier, the direct predecessors of the current, quote, independent, unquote, Croatia. Continuing. Indeed, the same day he brokered the Ustashi Pact, Germany invaded Zagreb. Ustashi militias were allowed free rein under Weissenmeyer's eye. It was Weissenmeyer's job to liaison with Ustashi leader Ante Pavelić. In the annals of wartime savagery against the Jews, there was no group as sadistic as the Croatian Ustashi. By the way, I would add to that, in the context of the atrocities that are reported here, one should note that the same types of atrocities were perpetrated by the Croats against the Serbs in World War II. That was one of the reasons for the lingering bitterness between Serb and Croat, and when the, quote, independent, unquote, Croatian state first took form, and that form was coincident with the fascist period in Croatia's history. That was one of the factors that convinced the Serbs that they had better get moving, otherwise they were going to end up like hundreds of thousands of Serbs did in World War II, and the sort of treatment meted out to Serbs, Jews, Gypsies, and others is described here, meted out by the Ustashi to their opponents, is described here in IBM and the Holocaust. In the annals of wartime savagery against the Jews, there was no group as sadistic as the Croatian Ustashi. Using chainsaws, knives, and rocks, frenzied, swastika-bedecked Ustashi brutally murdered thousands of Jews at a time. Ustashi leaders openly paraded about Zagreb with necklaces comprised of Jewish tongues and eyeballs cut and gouged from women and children, many of them raped and then dismembered or decapitated. Pavelić himself was fond of offering wicker baskets of Jewish eyeballs as gifts to his diplomatic visitors. And that, again, some of the connections maintained by Edmund Weissenmeyer, the head of the main liaison person between Nazi Germany and key corporations, and also a key functionary of the von Ribbentrop Foreign Ministry, as indicated there. There was a recent lawsuit by Gypsies, or Roma, against IBM. We should note that one of the groups that was deemed racially inferior by the Third Reich, and it was also subject to Third Reich persecution and also extermination, were the Gypsies, or Roma, as they're generally known in Europe. There has recently been a suit filed against IBM because just as it helped to identify Jews for the Third Reich, so too other ethnic groups, including Gypsies, were identified and slated for persecution and annihilation. This was reported in, among other newspapers, the Financial Times of London of Thursday, June 7th of the year 2001. This is an article by Francis Williams in Geneva. It's headlined, Gypsy Groups to File Nazi-Era Suit Against IBM. Gypsy organizations said yesterday they plan to file a civil suit in Geneva against IBM, the U.S. computer giant, seeking billions of dollars in compensation for the company's alleged complicity in the Holocaust in which upwards of 600,000 Gypsies perished. Henri-Philippe Sambuc, S-A-M-B-U-C, the Geneva lawyer bringing the case, said IBM tabulating machinery had helped the Nazi regime identify Jewish and Gypsy populations, quote, for industrial destruction, unquote. Geneva, located in neutral Switzerland, was the administrative center for IBM sales to Germany during the Second World War. The move by Gypsy International Recognition and Compensation Action, or GIRCA, G-I-R-C-A, follows publication in February of a book by Edwin Black detailing IBM's alleged role in the Nazis' extermination campaign. Gypsy groups claim that between 600,000 and 1.5 million Gypsies died in the Holocaust, representing over half the Romani population of Nazi-occupied Europe. Mr. Sambuk said yesterday that the suit would demand compensation of about $10,000 for each person orphaned, estimated to number at least 1.2 million, which would make the potential payout to $12 billion. It remains to be seen just what exactly what the implications will be for this lawsuit for the international globalization nexus. And as I indicated in numerous broadcasts, including For the Record program number 278, I believe that the Third Reich-related lawsuits against major American and German corporations has been one of the elements of coinage, I guess one could say, in the globalization process that has been dominating world economics over the last 10 to 20 years, or really more than that, but it's been formally doing so for the last decade or so. It's in the context of globalization that we're going to be taking a look at a tiny little landlocked country, which in fact is a major epicenter in world economic affairs and industrial affairs, and also has tremendous significance for the Bormann organization, the Underground Reich, and the economic component of an Underground Reich, about which I've spoken many times. We're going to be talking about Luxembourg, the Bormann organization, and a number of the connections that we've been talking about here, and this will also give us some perspective on the RTL television company and the going public, or the conversion of some of Bertelsmann stock for a public offering. That's going to be taking place in several years. However, we're going to get to that inside two of For the Record program number 309. I've alluded to other broadcasts during the course of this program. Those are available from a tape and CD duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, that's Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. You can email Spitfire at mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Spitfire List is one word. You can visit the Spitfire website, which features long descriptions of most of the broadcasts available, including mini article-length annotated descriptions of the For the Record programs. They've been footnoted for about the last year or so. You can visit the For the Record section on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Once again, that's one word, SPITFIRELIST.com. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, has put together a couple of websites, one of which is streaming the For the Record programs, and another of which has many of the For the Record broadcasts available for downloading on Real Audio. The streaming WFMU website is wfmu.org/Dave Emory. One word, DaveEmory. The other WFMU website, which is not streaming, but which has many of the For the Record programs available for downloading on Real Audio, is http://archive.wfmu.org/archive/D/X/. Listeners can email me at kfjcfm@demory@kfjc.org. People can also listen to the three-hour program that I do on KFJC in the South San Francisco Bay Area from 7 to 10 p.m. Pacific time at kfjc.org. Look in the Transmissions and Public Affairs section. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 309, The Ties That Bind. This is being recorded on July 1st of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.